Talk Shoe.
Recorded live.
Hello, everybody. This is Rick, and it is October the 18th, 2010, and this is the 911 marriage call. Thank you for joining us today. So the first question here is submitted. Hang on just a second. That is not quite working. Technical difficulty on this end. One moment, please. We're almost there. That's not correct. Okay, so let's stall here just a second. I apologize for having to fix this up again. We're almost there, so I'll just keep talking. So if anybody else comes online, they won't figure out that nobody else is here. So a little closer. And here it comes. There's one more thing. There, now we can fix it. That's what we want right there. Okay, everybody, thank you very much for your patience as I've tried to kind of work all this thing out, make sure this is fixed right now. Okay, good, we got it. So the first question for today is, what is the purpose of rehashing the hurt, anger, deceitful acts that occurred during the affair every week for 50 weeks? How does that help recovery? Thanks. Man, the purpose certainly is not to rehash the hurt, anger, deceitful acts that occurred during the affair for the first 50 weeks. I think that for many couples, having the courage to just address the issue gets to be an important piece. It's not a rehashing. It's actually, I mean, I think everybody knows what happened, but it's very much about intimacy. Am I willing to let another person know me and how I feel about it? Are we able to talk about it, expose how we feel about it, cry about it, grieve about it? And it's not even every day for 50 weeks. I think that at times one or the other may really be struggling with it, and it's appropriate to bring it up. Ultimately, what couples want to be able to do is come to the place where they can have an emotional conversation about the entire topic, where they can be honest with each other and begin to address really hard issues, maybe other issues that were in the relationship to begin with, that they've never been able to discuss. Affairs are really not the problem. They're a symptom of other issues, either within that individual or within the hurt spouse. I mean, like we say, our mate is never our problem. They just reveal the problems in us. And I think, you know, dealing with the disappointment and how do we process through that, how do we look at it, becomes an imperative part of working through things. Couples that tend to just stuff it and ignore it and try to go on and never really learn from it, gain from it, those couples, years down the road, don't do very well. What you want to be able to do is find new life as a result of everything you're going through, and finding new purpose, finding new meetings, finding deeper love, and finding a deeper intimacy, so that ultimately the infidelity becomes the thing that helps drive you forward, not the thing that rips you apart. But, you know, for most people, there's such pain associated with the infidelity for both parties that the talking about it is very, very difficult, and it is painful. And you can only hope over time that you can become grateful, that you begin to find meaning, and that that loss is ultimately transformed. It's just, it's part of grieving and beginning to see a deeper meaning for the two of you as a result, a new purpose in life. And so that's really the ultimate goal of that rehashing, as you would say. I hope that helps a little bit. Now, our second question. My husband and I attended EMS this past year. While there, I revealed to him the two other affairs I had while we were separated. You told me to give him the big major points of it and not go into too much detail. which I understand why. He thought, he, though, is the type that will make all the details in his head to put everything together. These details he comes up with are far worse than reality. He asked me to tell Ken the details, phone conversations, play-by-play of what happened, etc. And while I'm willing to be completely open and honest, I hesitate to do so. I don't want to make recovery harder than it is, but I want to do the best for him, for his healing. He's asked on several occasions now in the past 6 or so months for more information. I'm ready and willing to share, but not to his detriment. What do I do? So I would suggest asking him, if he will, to write out, first off, specifically the questions he has. I think he might find that, you may both kind of find that to be helpful, kind of what that would be. I would suggest, I don't know if he would be willing to speak with me or to maybe talk with a another male hurt spouse. Part of my question is, why does he want the information? If it's to get the questions out of his head, then, and he may have already worked hard at doing that, you know, he's got to be able to find, you know, ultimately, why is he looking? And I would say that you give him the detail if that's ultimately what he feels he needs. So, but you might stay with the, say, you know, if this is about comparing yourself against the other person, it's not an apples and apples comparison. And I think that's really the problem that people get into. They keep thinking that somehow it's about them when in reality it has nothing to do with them. And, but, you know, I think, or and when you're willing to share with them the details anyway, and they prayed about it and it feels like that's what they need, then all you can do is share and then they have to deal with that. I certainly don't know that we can dictate how much information they do or they don't need ultimately to heal, and different people want different levels of detail. I think that, you know, it may be helpful to him. But again, if he can write the questions out and, you know, say, okay, I'm going to tell you what you want, just let's try to keep it a rational conversation. If you can have a third party present, I would also say that might be helpful. Another person who might be able to translate and help mediate and keep things as reasonable as possible in the process. So if you've got a therapist, I'd recommend, if possible, to do it in front of your therapist. If not, maybe you can work with somebody on staff or a mentor couple to help go through that process. So, let's see. Next question, ground zero. I'm the unfaithful spouse, and partial disclosure 11 months ago, full disclosure completed 38 days ago. My wife forgave me the first time, but now she says it's too much. She feels that I went too far in betraying her all this past year for not being completely honest. She's full of anger and resentment. Now she's asking me for every single detail and doesn't believe any word I say. She's totally devastated, told me she can never love me again as before. I told her that I had never stopped loving her, and I've realized that I was caught up in limerence. I am back to ground zero. I don't know what to do. What do you think should be our next step? I learned from EMS that specific details don't help. What should I do? Actually, I think in a situation where there's been a great deal of deceit, the only way probably that you can deal with this is with specific details. So I would just, like I said in the previous question, I would say specifically, what is it that you feel you need to know? I will answer all your questions. I, you know, if it, you know, just make sure that you've prayed about it and you want the answer, because I'm going to give you the answer in as much detail as you would like. If you want more detail, then I'll give you more detail to the extent that I can. I'm going to answer everything. And I think that, especially where there's been kind of an ongoing deception, where you've, you know, continued to not be honest and not let her in. The only way she can see any sort of change and the only way she can ever begin to trust you is if she senses that ultimately you're really trusting her with the information. And so in that sense, As difficult as it may be for her, I think you give her that information. The largest, or the, I think one of the most difficult pieces of that is it really does require that we let go of our own ego and our own pride as we kind of expose who we really are. And hopefully by the grace of God, they'll be able to accept us. Anything short of that, and if you think about it, really is incredibly manipulative, because now what you're doing is, you know, you're kind of controlling them by the flow of information, and you're robbing them of their choices. And you'll never be loved unconditionally as long as you only conditionally let another person know who you are. It takes a great deal of commitment and a great deal, I think, to God and to self, and even a self-awareness to begin to share fully who you are and what you are. And I just pray that God will grant you the courage ultimately to do that. So let's see, next question for the day. Hang on just a second while I refresh here. I am a betraying spouse, and the question is, what is brokenness? How can I get there? If I cannot, I don't see much hope for our relationship. To me, brokenness is the place where I get completely out of the way, and it's no longer about my image. I mean, I have the broken image. I see that. I'm not trying to, I've given up. I've let go. I'm not trying to look a certain way. I'm not trying to, you know, blow smoke. I'm just trying to be as honest with myself and honest with others. I mean, I desire that. I've let go of my illusions that somehow I'm good. I've accepted that, you know, in a sense, or maybe that I can do it, that I have something. I live in that place of brokenness where I have nothing, and know that, you know, if there's not a God bigger than me, who is that I can surrender to, who take over, that I, you know, can release to, then nothing will happen. Because in my brokenness, I recognize there's nothing in me that is capable. And so I walk in a humility, and I think humility is a good word for brokenness. To me, the best definition there's for humility is two words. It's just, I can't. It's not about judging other people anymore and thinking they ought to be a certain way. That focus is strictly on me and the acceptance of what I can't do finally, and the admission of that, and desperately trying to stay in that place so that what's important isn't even trying to get better. I think in brokenness, maybe we give up trying to get better, but we begin to see the world through a different light, maybe through the very eyes of God, where if I can really die to self and die to that ego and that pride, ultimately, I can begin to care about others and think about them versus thinking about self. Again, I don't worry about what it's going to cost me. I'm just worried about what I'm costing other people. So hopefully that helps. I know that when I first went into recovery, brokenness was an interesting concept to me, and because I knew that's where my joy and my strength was. It's one of those things where I'm weak. He's strong, and I knew as long as I could make weakness the goal and surrender the goal, then ultimately there was hope. But the second that I got back to the place where I thought I wasn't broken and I could do it, I knew that everything would fail. Hopefully that'll help you a little bit with brokenness. Next question. Along. My husband's long-term emotional affair with his ministry assistant began in 98 and 99 and became full and physical in 2004. We separated for a couple of years and had a divorce to the point and had divorce almost to the point of being finalized when we decided to give it another try. My husband's been unwilling to talk much about his affair, but thinks I should get over it and move on like he has. However, he started talking about his feelings just in the last few months. He's told me several times now that he started to see me as being my own self, separate from him for the first time ever, and that he finds that it's okay that he actually likes who I am, that I don't, in fact, have to exist to be some sort of extension of him, to do, to be, and to think like him all the time. He says that this doesn't make me wrong all the time. I'm just different from him. And in reality, what he's describing is basically the kind of the definition of differentiation. It's that ability to, you know, hold on to my own sense of self in the face, in the space of another person, not feeling like I have to be different to be with them, or that they have to be different in order to be with me. I have been in observation mode. I learned the hard way that I shouldn't get all excited over everything he says. That sounds like maybe he's finally starting to pull his head up out of one of his human orifices. I've learned that he's really good at looking really good. And I've learned that who he looks like on the surface really isn't what I see when he gets pressed from any direction. Recently, he was telling me again about how he's seeing things and me differently from before. He said, and I quote, "Even though I have absolute God-given veto rights over you, I've learned to appreciate you, to appreciate who you are, and I like you, and it's okay if we don't see things the same way because you're not wrong, it's different. Absolute God-given veto rights over me, question mark, what? I've been married to this man 26 years, and I have no clue he believed this way. Any thoughts?" Well, my first thought is, if you had no clue that he believed this way, I think that probably just says a little bit about the lack of communication. And, you know, one thought that I would have is, you know, there's some really serious conversations that the two of you need to have. It's, you know, when I look at deal breakers in a marriage, what is a good indication that a marriage isn't going to make it and don't even go forward? I mean, I think the number one thing for me is someone's unwillingness to really be committed to what it's going to take, an unwillingness to do the process. And because if you don't have someone who is going to do their own personal work, it feels to me a lot of times, other than, I mean, obviously we can compromise and keep adjusting to who the other person is to keep the relationship together, but that's not the same as ultimately doing a relationship. I think that probably has far more to do with just ultimately keeping the appearance of a relationship. But relationships are about a sharing of hearts and a sharing of life. It's about a willingness to let another person really know me and a willingness to really get to know another person. And it's not, I mean, he's right, it's about those differences and not feeling like, it's an appreciation of those. And that's where union begins to come in. I mean, I don't think that you can really have oneness in a situation where you live under the illusion thinking the other person is just like you. Nor can there be much of a relationship if there's not humility and brokenness, as we spoke about earlier on the call, where the other person feels like they're right all the time and somehow, you know, it's okay for you to be you, but ultimately, you know, I'm the one who's right. There's a book by Robert Lewis that maybe you could get him to read that I think is very good, called, it used to be called Rocking the Roles. I suspect if you Google it, you could find it. But he does a really good job from a biblical perspective, looking at the different roles, and you know, from that perspective, I mean, from rocking the roles, I would just say that he is supposed to be in your marriage relationship a servant leader. I mean, he's someone that's supposed to love you to the point of being willing to just totally give himself up and serve you and love you. And your submission, your mission under his mission, ultimately, is to let him love you, not to be his slave. I think this is a co-equal relationship with an interesting structure. So I would... give you equal questions and honesty that couples have to be able to have, rational conversations. If they're ever going to find life in a relationship, if they're going to have something that I think lasts through the ages, that is alive and that doesn't just, you know, where it's not just a pretense. You know, I heard Jeff Van Vonderen say once in Families Where Grace Is in Place, and I thought it was always a good point. He said, you know, oftentimes we think that not getting divorced is kind of the ultimate goal. But in reality, many couples have divorced their mate long ago in their hearts. And he raised the question. He said, I just wonder if, you know, the stench of a dead marriage where they're really not doing relationship anymore, but pretending to still be together, if that's not just as abhorrent to God as divorce. Neither are about oneness. Neither are about love. Neither of them are about union. Neither of them are about intimacy and somehow imaging God. So in that sense, you know, I think not getting divorced just out of moral constraints, and don't know that that's necessarily a good thing either. I mean, it's hopeful that he's sitting there talking as he's talking at this point, in terms of just seeing you different. But if you still can't talk and you can't address difficult situations, and if there's not a willingness on his part to let you know him, and a willingness on yours to be known by him, even a willingness for him to honestly look at himself and to know himself, almost being intimate with himself, there's not a lot of hope for depth in that relationship. So hopefully that can help a little bit and give you some directions. And hope you enjoy the book as much as Stephanie and I ended up kind of enjoying that book when we went through it. Gave us some really good things to talk about. So with that, that's the end of our questions for the day. I want to thank everybody for joining the call. And I'll, you know, get your questions posted for next week. These were great questions today, and I just look forward to seeing what we get to address next week. Hope everybody has a good week and to healing. Bye-bye.